You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Phishing scams continue to nibble away at bank accounts and reputations. Avoid emails promising you leaked pictures of YouTube stars. Chinese espionage against U.S. targets rise. U.S. intelligence officials worry that failure to play a long game puts the country at a disadvantage with respect to innovation. The Joint Chiefs mull electronic warfare issues. Reality Winner makes a plea agreement in her espionage case. The U.S. Supreme Court decides a landmark privacy case. And the journey from ecstasy tablets to Iranian spying is a short, sad road. From the CyberWire studios at DataTribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Friday, June 22nd, 2018. Phishing scammers are showing an ability to bypass natural language-based anti-phishing protections and induce Office 365 users into compromising their credentials. We're midway through the baseball season, and this prompts us to reflect on an analogy with information security. If zero-day exploits are grand slams, big, damaging, spectacular, and rare, then phishing is small ball, working the count, hitting away from the shift, pitching to contact, hit and run, and so on. And phishing remains a perennial problem in all of its tiresome but successful forms. And what are the fish biting on these days? To move away from our baseball metaphor and back to angling, leaked images of YouTube star is serving as surprisingly compelling fish bait. It's especially prevalent in South Korea, but users everywhere should avoid this come-on. There are, of course, such things as YouTube stars, and there are, reportedly, leaked and revealing images of those stars. Stay away. Read a good book. Take a walk. Travel. Divert yourself. But don't click. Phishing has more victims than just the unfortunate curious ones who click. The U.S. state of Oregon became aware Monday that an email account using its oregon.gov domain had been compromised and used in a massive phishing campaign. The direct damage phishing does to those who fail to recognize and spit the hook is well known, but those whose accounts and domains are hijacked also suffer. Oregon is still struggling to get its domain removed from the many blacklists to which it was added after the phishing campaign. Chinese espionage against U.S. targets increases as trade tensions between the two countries rise. U.S. officials seem to be experiencing two minor Sputnik moments, call them Sputnishki. Speaking at the Capitol Hill National Security Forum, NSA Deputy Director George Barnes says the U.S. isn't good at playing a long game, unlike adversaries like China. Richard Cardillo, director of the National Geospatial Agency, substantially agreed, citing quantum computing and cybersecurity as two areas in which U.S. innovation may come too late. China, they say, thinks routinely in 20-year terms. The Americans do not. They forget and must reinvent, and a tradition of technological progress seems to have bred a very distinctive version of victory disease. Too much winning can make you think winning will just go on forever. One such victory disease hangover is being felt, apparently, in the second Sputnishka. General Paul Selva, vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs, told the Center for a New American Security that American complacency about encryption and precision timing have enabled peer adversaries to steal a march in electronic warfare. If you rely on technical virtuosity as a magic bullet, you may find yourself outclassed by an opposition that remembers the old slow grind that you've forgotten. NSA and Air Force alumna Reality Winner has agreed to a plea deal over charges related to provision of highly classified documents to The Intercept. The government said that while she was working as an NSA contractor at Fort Gordon, Georgia, she leaked a top-secret report about Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Ms. Winner was charged under the Espionage Act and faced 10 years in prison and $250,000 in fines. Her family continues to support her, with her mother telling the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that, quote, "I do know that she has always been ready and willing to accept responsibility for any wrongdoing, and that she will accept the consequences," end quote. Ms. Winner's mother has also tweeted that her daughter is a hero and a true patriot. Making due allowance for maternal love and natural affection, we suppose that is one way of looking at it. Gonen Segev, a former member of Israel's Knesset and once the country's energy minister, has been arrested on suspicion of spying for Iran. The arrest caps a post-government career that, since the mid-90s, has earned him a serious ne'er-do-well's reputation. He was involved in fraud, claiming his bank account had been looted from an ATM. A security camera showed that he himself had withdrawn the cash. Later, in 2004, he tried to smuggle 32,000 tablets of ecstasy into Israel. He did a couple of years in prison when the authorities and the court didn't buy his explanation that, in fact, the tablets were just a big consignment of M&M candies. Segev, who's also a medical doctor, had established a practice in Nigeria. That's where he was recruited by Iranian intelligence services. If you run through the traditional acronym of motives for becoming an agent, MICE, that is, money, ideology, compromise, or ego, Segev seems to have been driven by the big M, money.
Every day, your IAM tech debt grows. Your multi-generational services struggle to work together. Building an identity fabric can fix this. It makes all your identity tooling stronger and allows you to connect any app to any service you want to use. With zero coding, zero maintenance, and zero app downtime. Strata's identity orchestration platform separates the identity logic from your applications, so you can optimize existing IAM tools and manage them in a single control plane. Now, every vendor, standard, and architecture work together. In short, building your identity fabric means you can secure your non-standard apps, keep your complex access policies, retire outdated IDPs, and modernize in record time. So build your fabric with Strata Identity and get rid of tech debt for good. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your identity priorities, and receive a pair of AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations over 5,000 employees. Connect today at strata.io/cyberwire.
And joining me once again is Ben Yellen. He's a senior law and policy analyst at the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. Ben, a big day today. The U.S. Supreme Court came down with an important privacy ruling here. Fill us in. What do we have going on?
Sure. So the decision is Carpenter v. the United States, and this is a decision about cell site location information. So Mr. Carpenter was part of a crime syndicate, a ring of people who were robbing, ironically, cell phone stores. And as part of a federal investigation into this crime, the government obtained cell site location information records on the whereabouts of Mr. Carpenter. They realized that he was at the location of some of these robberies. They used that information to convict him, and he was sentenced to over 100 years in prison. So Carpenter challenged his arrest on Fourth Amendment grounds, and he said that the government needs a warrant to obtain cell site location information. This presented a novel issue, and that's why it made it up to the Supreme Court. Previously, we've been under what we call the third-party doctrine. I know you and I have discussed this at length in the past. The Supreme Court has held that if you voluntarily submit information to third parties that the third parties keep as their business records, then you have forfeited your reasonable expectation of privacy in that information. Therefore, you do not have any Fourth Amendment protection in that information. There hasn't been a Fourth Amendment search. And what the Supreme Court was wrestling with here is whether to extend the third-party doctrine to instances like this one, where you're not just revealing perhaps one phone number that you dialed or one bank record that you submitted, but rather a wealth of comprehensive information on your whereabouts for a relatively long period of time. And the decision that came down today from Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, who joined the court's four more liberal members, says that the government does in fact need a warrant to obtain your cell site location information. And this is a massive victory for electronic privacy advocates. It's really a groundbreaking case. The decision rests on basically two principles that distinguish the information being collected here from the information that has been collected in previous third-party doctrine cases. And what Justice Roberts says is both the breadth and depth and the comprehensiveness of the information revealed is just so fundamentally different in this case. Cell site location information reveals not only your whereabouts, but can give any potential viewer, whether it's somebody in the public or whether it's the government, information on your private associations, your religious or political affiliations. I mean, imagine if somebody followed you for a full week, how much information they could find about you. Hmm. Whereas in the past, we were talking about how much information a person, somebody could find out about you by virtue of dialing one phone number. I mean, it's just a fundamental difference in the information that's being submitted. And that's, I think, the main justification that Justice Roberts is using here. The other justification he talks about is the fact that in most third-party doctrine cases, a person should have full knowledge that they are submitting or they are transmitting information that's going into the hands of a third party. So, for instance, when I make a call on my cell phone, I know that I get a cell phone bill every month. I know that that call is recorded. I know that's going to be part of AT&T's business records. Here, Justice Roberts says it's not so clear-cut. People have an idea that their information is on their physical location is being collected by the cell phone companies, but we don't really, as a society, have a fundamental understanding of how that works. This voluntariness that's so fundamental for the third party doctrine is just not really present here. We're not actively pressing a button that submits information to a third party. And even if you take out that voluntariness equation, even if you think that simply by turning on our cell phones, we are voluntarily conveying our information to our cell phone company and thus potentially to the government, it's just not really fair to expect that people will go without their cell phones because they don't want the government to know where they are at all times. Cell phones are such a fundamental part of our lives. We use them for our familial relations. We use them in our work life and our personal life. It wouldn't be realistic to expect people to stop using cell phones just because they would be forfeiting a right to privacy by pressing the on switch. And that's sort of the basis for Justice Roberts' decision. A couple of notes, I would say. There are no bright lines in the decision. I think a lot of scholars were looking for whether there was some sort of determinant factor that would make the transmission of cell site location information into a Fourth Amendment search. Perhaps there would be some sort of time requirement, like if the information was collected over a period of 7 days or more, that would constitute a search. There was no bright line like that in this case. And that's something that the four dissenting justices have really harped on, that this might not be an easy decision for local law enforcement, state law enforcement, or federal law enforcement to follow because there are no bright line standards. But I think the bottom line, it's a major victory for privacy advocates. Not only do we have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the location information that we submit to our cell phone companies, but we've cut against this very broad third-party doctrine. There's now an understanding that just because we voluntarily transmit information to a third party, that doesn't necessarily mean we have forfeited our reasonable expectation of privacy. It has to do with the quality and the quantity of information that we submit and whether that submission was in fact voluntary. So I think it's a groundbreaking decision.
Ben Yellen, thanks for explaining it to us. I'm sure this is something you and I are going to continue to talk about in days to come. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely, and I apologize for being so long-winded.
Oh, no, it's an important one. Thanks
it sure
so much, Ben.
Is. Thanks, Dave. Bye-bye.
My guest today is Tavi Kotka. He's the former chief information officer for the nation of Estonia, where they enjoy a national digital identity system. He's a special advisor to the European Commission and is currently CEO of a company called Proud Engineers. Our conversation focuses on Estonia's digital identity system and how it affects privacy and security.
First of all, you have to understand Estonian ICT architecture. So it's the fully distributed solution, and to connect all those different distributed systems. In Estonia, we have like every person has a unique identifier, and this unique identifier is used in private sector, in healthcare, in government, basically everywhere. So if we need to get information about the person, we can actually combine different data sets between different sectors. That's the first thing. So we have a very strong baseline for data connectivity. And every Estonian who is older than 15 years, mandatory, they have to have a digital identity. So government demands that everybody has to have a digital identity. And like this way, using digital identity, we can sign documents, we can open, authenticate ourselves, like open any kind of government portal or private sector portal. So it's very widely used. We actually have to say that like digital identity is widely used. The technology is actually different. Like some people using ID cards, some people using mobile IDs, some people use smart IDs. So it's important that everybody has digital identity. It's not so important what's the technology they're using.
Now, were there any privacy concerns that went along with that?
Funny, I get this question always from US, like, is there a privacy concern? People think that if everything is digital and everything is connected, that then they have to give away their privacy. I mean, it might be true if the government has like dictatorship or like they have... they want to have full control over the data, what they own, like, let's say, China. But Estonia is a democratic country. And we believe, like other North European countries, like Sweden or Finland, that being digital is actually more privacy protective compared with being analog. I mean, I take an example. Do you know who has looked your health records in your local hospital that you're using? Give me an honest answer.
No, I do not.
But I know. And that's the point. I mean, everything is digital. Yes, every patient record is in Estonia is digital. But also I can see who has looked at it. Not only they changed it, but also who has looked at it. Meaning that I actually have more control over my data compared with you. And that's the point. I mean, like if you don't want to be a control-freaking dictatorship with a democratic country, you will build a system like it has built in Estonia that everybody has a power to see who has accessed or approached their data. If there is no reasonable explanation, this person gets fired or even goes to jail. And suddenly you become your own big brother. I mean, like, let's say a policeman or a doctor, yes, they have access to your data, actually not a certain amount of data, but they know if they don't have a reason, they will be kicked out from the system and they will lose their jobs. So suddenly you understand that like you can build those digital systems and you can get the benefits of those digital systems, but still keep the privacy, or even better, you can increase the privacy and data protection. Because, for example, if there is something in my health record that I don't like, let's say I have some kind of mental problem 10 years ago, so I can actually cover that data. So even though every doctor can see my data, yes, they have to have a reason. But if there's something I truly want to forget and I truly want to cover that, I'm allowed to do that. So if you think about it like this way, you can get both better services, but also increased privacy.
How does it compare when it comes to things like identity theft?
I'll give an example. If you are able to go to court and prove that somebody has stolen your digital identity, but you still own or obsess your ID card and you haven't given your PINs to anybody, if you're able to prove that in court that somebody has stolen your identity, the government takes the liability up to 5 million euros and it has never been used.
So what are your recommendations? What could the United States, for example, do to improve our identity systems?
It's actually not a question of the identity system. It's a question, do you actually have a pain to solve? Countries think that they want to be digital, but if you ask them why, I mean, I can ask you, why you America wants to be digital, like digital government? Why you think you actually need that? It's a complicated task. It's difficult. You have to make many compromises with society. Like, and life in the U.S. is good. Actually, it's better than in Estonia. So why to change? Why not? Why you actually have to do that? I mean, please answer me.
Well, I suppose there could be cost savings. There could be security advantages. Certainly things could be easier. I would love to see, for example, medical records to be easier to navigate and to share from doctor to doctor.
Okay, but is it painful enough? Is it painful enough to actually start building solutions to that? That's the point. I mean, the pain in your society hasn't reached the moment where it actually, explains that or basically justifies that, okay, we need to do the change now. When you actually articulate that I have certain pain and then the only way to solve that is being digital, then you start thinking, how can I solve this problem? And then you find out that, it seems to be that being digital is actually more privacy protective than being analog. But without having that pain, you never reach to those questions. So Estonia, like other Nordic and North European countries, we actually share the same pain. Our pain is that we have a lot of land and not too many people. So many people live in rural areas and they don't have physical access to the bank office or government officer. So they have to use IT solutions like internet bank or a government portal or whatever it is. So we had to push people to use these services. So we have that pain, and that's why we are more advanced in this field. But you don't have that pain.
That's Tavi Kotka. He's the former chief information officer of Estonia.
Are lengthy security reviews pulling attention away from your security program? With the largest network of trust centers, Vanta can help you streamline security reviews to win customer trust, save time, and close deals fast. Proactively demonstrate security by showcasing key resources like your SOC 2 or ISO 27001 and provide real-time evidence for passing controls. And when a security questionnaire is required, Vanta takes the first pass for you. Visit vanta.com/cyber to take a self-serve tour. That's vanta.com/cyber.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Hey, listeners. We're always looking for ways to improve the N2K CyberWire network and maintain the intelligence-driven news experience that keeps you in the know on the latest developments in cybersecurity. We've launched our 2024 audience survey and would love for you to take a few minutes to share your feedback. And hey, there's even a chance to win a $100 Amazon gift card if you complete the survey. Visit cyberwire.com/survey. That's cyberwire.com/survey and share your feedback now.